House Finance Committee come to order. Time is 2:00 PM on April 29th. For the record, we have Representative Moses Lancaster, myself Williams, Co-Chair Mulder, Vice Chair Bundy, Representative Whitaker, Croft, and Davies. Today we have five bills before us, and we're going to start with 519. And if we don't, I'm sorry, we're going to go with House Bill 6. Yeah, so Representative Harris is also present. Representative Davies?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. To save time, I'll go from right here. House Bill 6 is a very simple idea. We have in our statutes right now an option that municipalities may exercise, which is to exempt $10,000 from the value of a person's primary residence. It's a provision, I believe, that was enacted originally to encourage homeownership. That provision was put in our statutes in 1973. If we simply use the usual CPI inflator on that number, $10,000, the current value of that should be about $40,000. That's what this bill does, is basically bring that $10,000 number that we enacted in 1973 up to today's value of $40,000. In addition to that, Mr. Chairman, it does one other thing. It also looks to the service that we get out of volunteers in the fire departments, in the emergency medical technician folks, and says, because we appreciate the volunteer effort that you put into our community, it allows a municipality, if they wish to, again, all of this is optional at the municipal level, to grant an additional $20,000 exemption for those folks. Now, that has almost no impact on the total impact of the state, that second provision. It's possible that if every single municipality that could take advantage of this did, and every single municipality took advantage in a way that was the most detrimental to the state, that it could cost the state about $1.5 million in lost tax revenues. But I believe that that number should be listed as indeterminate, because in the first place, I don't believe that every single municipality will take advantage of it. And secondly, I don't believe that every municipality that does take advantage of it will use it in this way. The way I intend municipalities to use it is to reduce property tax, to just reduce property taxes for their residential property taxpayers. And because in many communities, yours and your, especially the co-chair from Muldoon and mine, property taxes have gotten pretty high on the homeowners. And so I'm trying to just bring this, again, optional municipal exemption up to date. Thank you.
Are there any questions? The department, is anyone from the department here to talk on this?
Did I get Department of Revenue to comment on the fiscal note?
Yes. Blair?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, I'm Larry Persley, Deputy Commissioner of the Department of Revenue, and the sponsor, Representative Davies, is correct. The number in the fiscal note would be if every community gave the full exemption we allowed under the statute, and then made up for that lost revenue by raising, rather than cutting spending or finding alternative revenue sources, made up for that by raising the mill rate as much as needed, which would impose more of a burden on, in this case, oil and gas property owners, where the state would lose some of that. But we have Randy Hoffback of our tax division in Anchorage on the line who could answer specific questions about that. Anyway, so Representative Davies is correct. It could be anywhere from zero to 1.6 million in terms of the impact on the state. And Mr. Hoffback could answer technical questions about how the tax works if the committee would like.
Randy, do you have anything further to add?
No, I think he's pretty well covered it.
Thank you. Any questions for either people right now? Thank you, Larry. Steve Vincent, do you have anything you'd like to add or
No, Mr. Chairman, I'm just here to answer any more questions.
Thank you.
Or I guess that's...
David Tyler, Fairbanks LIO.
Speaking.
Yes, you want to give your testimony?
Yes, sir, thank you. Speaking today on behalf of the Alaska State Fire Chiefs Association and my department, North Star Volunteer Fire Department, speak in favor of House Bill 6. I think this is a long overdue opportunity for us to recognize the contributions our volunteers make to the community. In my particular case, we totaled up the volunteer hours, as we do every year. We have to give this to our accountants for calculating our in-kind donations we receive. We had 24,600, nearly 25,000 hours of time donated last year. And the accountants used a figure of $12 an hour to calculate the value of that, which I think is low, but that still comes in right at just under $300,000. I think this is a good turnaround, a good way to recognize volunteers. And as I mentioned before, there's two different types of volunteers that we have. We have the young folks that come through with the fire service as a career. They're working, they're gaining their knowledge, their experience, and they're usually in and out within 2 or 3 years. But this benefit, this incentive would target the people who are already residing in our service area, who are homeowners, who are raising their families, and have their careers right there. And these are the people that are going to stick around for 5, 10, 15, 20 years. And this is the heart and soul of our department. This is where the longevity, this is where our leaders come from. And I appreciate Representative Davies' efforts with this and strongly support it. Thank you.
Thank you, David. Go to Homer LIO, Robin Prosector.
This is Robin Proctor. I am an EMT with the Anchor Point Fire Department, have been so for over 15 years, and I'm also an EMT instructor. And I would like to urge you to support House Bill 6. Emergency and fire services, particularly those that are volunteer, are faced with significant recruitment and retention problems. This problem is so significant that the Governor's Alaska Council on Emergency Medical Services listed the retention and recruitment of volunteers as one of their goals consistently since the fiscal year of 1998. Volunteers are often recognized for their heroic efforts in saving lives and protecting property. These volunteers give of their time, and we often don't recognize the financial implications of volunteering. There are numerous costs involved in volunteering, costs of fuel, vehicle repairs associated with responding swiftly to an emergency on a gravel road, child care, and lost wages when that volunteer must leave work. I interpret House Bill 6 to be a cost recovery benefit to volunteers. If this bill passes, it would make it possible for municipalities to provide a tax benefit for those who volunteer. This would, in a small way, assist them with the recovery of some of the personal expenditures that are associated with their efforts. Volunteers not only respond to medical or fire emergencies, they must attend a significant amount of training classes and continuing education to remain current on their certification. Our particular department has training meetings for both fire and EMS personnel on a weekly basis. Certification requirements must be met for EMS providers, which require many hours of training just to be current with that certification. Anchor Point Volunteer Fire Department personnel responded 1,035 times last year, which does not include any training time. If you were to consider the amount of funds these volunteers spent just on fuel for their vehicles, the benefits of this bill wouldn't even actually cover their actual costs. I urge you to pass this bill and any others that might have benefit to volunteers. These are the people who save the lives and property of your loved ones in a time of need. This is a small effort in showing your appreciation and may be a significant dividend in the retention and recruitment issue. I do have concerns about the wording of the proposed bill, where it refers to giving municipalities the ability to give exemptions. And would this, in fact, be covered by the borough governments as well? I thank you for this opportunity to testify and urge you to act in an effort to continue to support such vital services.
Thank you, Robin. Next, we'll have Ron Wilhite.
Good I'd like you to know that we're bound by federal mandates for the number of minimum personnel for operations on a fire scene. We have to have two in and two out on a safety hose. We have to have a couple people on rapid intervention teams. We need an engineer, an officer. We need tanker drivers because we don't have hydrants. And so if I don't have enough people, I'm faced with two options. Either limit the attack to an exterior attack or pursue operations that are out of compliance with an FPA and OSHA. Well, if I had more people, I could save more houses. And anything we can do to increase recruitment and retention would help save lives and property. Thank you for the time.
Thank you, Ron. For those that have written testimony, if you could please fax your written testimony to 465-6813, I'd appreciate it. Anyone else on teleconference?
No. We have one more person in Fairbanks, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Fairbanks, Eric Moorman. Moorman. Eric.
Thank you very much for allowing me to testify in regards to this bill. I represent Cheney Goldstream Fire and Rescue, which is a volunteer organization. We have 47 volunteers and a small space staff. Volunteers commit approximately 23,000 hours of volunteer time to citizens of my district. I believe that this House bill goes a long ways to doing recognition of the tremendous amount of savings that they provide both to my residents and the persons who pass my community. I certainly encourage you to support House Bill 6 and appreciate your efforts on this behalf.
Thank you. Representative Bundy.
A question for the sponsor. I support and appreciate where you're going. This is basically, though, remuneration for services, and what will the IRS have to say about this?
Representative Davies?
I don't know for sure what the impact would be. I don't think that, my view is that it's not remuneration for services. It's just a recognition that of an appreciation for volunteer efforts. It's not going to be tied to a specific number of hours. So I suspect that there won't be an IRS issue. But in the worst case, the IRS would just tax the benefit.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think in other cases where there have been in-kind sorts of things, and I would rather that they didn't, but I think we should be aware that it's a possibility they might tax it.
Any other questions? Any amendments?
Yeah. Mr. Chairman, I've just been handed an amendment by Representative Davies. He handed it to me. It's his amendment. He tells me it's a good one.
Oh, let's vote for it then.
I wonder what it is. You'll have to ask him.
Could you explain to Representative Davies, please?
Yeah, it just it was a potential ambiguity that arose in the last committee hearing, and we worked with the committee chair and the drafter, Ms. Cook, to clear up the ambiguity. It just makes clear that if there are two more individuals eligible for the exemption on the same that live in the same household, that there's only one exemption granted per household.
You've heard the amendment. Is there any objection to the amendment? Not so ordered. Any other amendments? Representative?
I'll go ahead and move H.B. 6 out of committee with individual recommendations as amended. Will you attach this note?
Any objections? No. Or we'll move from committee. Next, we'll go to 519.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
It's not Mueller.
Perhaps should be Representative Cott, but anyway, I did, after visiting with a number of the members over the weekend after we last met on this, it was surprising to me to find out that most people didn't realize that the producer's study wasn't conceived that it was public. So I thought it would be worthwhile to have a presentation made of that study before the committee as we're deliberating this process. So with that, Mr. Speaker, or Mr. Chairman, I know that I've included this in everybody's packet. But Representative Cott, who's going to make the presentation? It's going to be Mr. Hurley? Michael?
They're
on teleconference? Okay.
Okay, we have Ken Conrad, drummer Murushak, and Robbie
Shelab.
Shelab. Who would like to go first?
Representative Williams, this is Joe Murushak. What we normally do on these presentations is just walk through them a page at a time, and we just normally, each of us kind of share comments, and then if this is all right, we'll try to take breaks in between. It's a little hard to tell on the phone when you have an issue. So after every page, we'll just stop a second and see if there's any question. And I'd recommend we go through this pretty fast to save your time, and then you can stop us. Is that reasonable?
As long as we get the person's name for the record that talking, that sounds good.
Okay. All right. Well, let me start. This is Joe Murushak, Phillips. And I'll start on, if you will, page 4. What you'll see before that is just we have some summary statements here on how the presentation goes, but the real project's overview starts on page 4. And on that page, you'll see a map that shows the northern route in green, the northern route in pink, the southern route in green, and then the line from Calgary or from Gordondale south to Chicago in blue. We've spent $125 million on this project, and this is the summary of what we'd like to present to you. During this time period, we had 110 owner staff representatives. We put over 1 million man hours working on this with 20% in the field. We performed environmental and field studies on 5,400 miles of right-of-way. And we feel this is probably the most complete study that's been done on this effort, at least real time from 2001 on. You turn to page 5, this is Robbie Shillam. The conclusions are summarized there. Bottom line is that as we've gone through this and updated the cost estimates, our determination is that the risks still outweigh the rewards. Although the rewards are there, the risks are greater. And that any additional engineering in a substantial manner would not be justified at this time. Any future activity would have to match the progress we would desire with governments and the commercial viability. And that's really what we'll be talking about today. In the form of governments, they play a key role in reducing the project cost, and especially the schedule risk. And what we'll talk about is the U.S. federal regulatory enabling legislation that's taking place now in Washington. The National Energy Board and the First Nations regulatory process in Canada, and then finally the lack of fiscal certainty that would be the process in Alaska.
This is Ken Conrad with BP. Calling in from Anchorage. If you turn to page 7, we kind of give a high-level overview of the basic design parameters of the project, which starts with a gas treatment plant on the North Slope, a pipeline from Alaska into Alberta, an NGL plant somewhere along the system, most likely either in Alberta or further south, and then an evacuation plan from Alberta into Lower 48 pipelines. The one thing to catch on here, we did our initial work that was communicated in September timeframe. We were talking about a 4 BCF a day pipeline, and now we're talking about a 4.5 BCF a day pipeline with initial expansion potential up to around 5.6 billion cubic feet a day, and then there would certainly be subsequent expansion opportunities beyond that. About 24 compressor stations with a total installed horsepower over a million horsepower, and the mileages you'll see there. The one other change we made was that we're now looking at a base design of a 52-inch pipeline relative to a 48-inch pipeline when we, based on some of the initial screening work we had done. But in any event, an enormous project with 50 million draft hours needed for construction and 5 to 6 million tons of steel.
Hey, Kim, why don't you finish up this section? This feels a little cumbersome doing it this way.
Okay. On page 8, you'll see the start of the system is the gas treatment plant, which would be located on the north slope. And this this picture here shows how it would set in relative to the existing central compression plant at Prudhoe Bay and the central gas facility. And you'll see the scale of this plant is actually quite substantial, and it's actually larger than any of the other existing facilities in place. The plant would be, the primary purpose of the plant would be to remove carbon dioxide from the gas stream from both the Point Thompson unit as well as the Prudhoe Bay unit or any other gas fields that would subsequently produce gas on the north slope for CO2 removal and compression. The plant would discharge at about 2,500 PSI, which is the design pressure of the pipeline. This is a big plant. It's about 140,000 tons, and the primary method of CO2 removal would be via with a traditional amine system, and then after running it through amine, the gas picks up water, so we have to subsequently dehydrate the gas, and there would probably be some infrastructure sharing with the existing Prudhoe facilities, although clearly the lion's share of this, vast majority of this would be new build. The total cost is about $2.5 billion, $2.6 billion, and the average fuel consumption would be about over 100 million cubic feet a day, or 150 million cubic feet a day. If you move to slide or page 9, we show the Alaska to Alberta, the second major part of the project, which is the pipeline into Alberta. And I think most of us are aware there's some unique challenges around an Arctic pipeline of this magnitude. Key amongst them is river crossings for this size of pipe presents some challenges, as well as going through permafrost, and especially discontinuous permafrost. The design parameters in frozen ground is fairly straightforward. It needs to be refrigerated, but then in areas, the majority of the route, it actually passes through either discontinuous permafrost or sporadic permafrost, and in those areas, the temperature of the pipeline needs to be controlled within a very tight range to ensure that we neither permanently freeze the soil nor thaw permafrost areas. There's also some fairly steep terrain, especially along the southern route, and there is seismic activity through the area, so we need to be able to design for earthquakes and the such. And just quickly on page 10, it shows the elevation profile of the two routes. When we see the southern route crossing through initially there, going through Attican Pass, which is a substantial challenge, and then crossing mostly rolling ground, but occasional pretty rugged terrain through the route. And then the northern route runs a more gradual incline, not quite as rough a terrain. And then finally, on page 11, we show the Alberta to market pipeline. What we have done is designed a system that would evacuate gas from the terminus of the Alaska to Alberta pipeline to market. We're using that as a benchmark or a test against other opportunities that may evolve in the market. There's certainly a wealth of pipeline infrastructure in the in Alberta. However, it's clear to everyone that infrastructure would need to be expanded in order to accommodate the Alaskan volumes. And what we would propose is to compare the cost and the efficiency of expanding the older systems versus building the new pipeline. So that this case has been developed as a reference. If indeed other solutions evolve that can be more cost-effective, that would be the direction that we would go. On slide 12, just to review, we talked earlier, we, you know, 5,400 miles of right-of-way that was investigated, and we actually sent a lot of crews out in the field across Alaska, across Canada, and into the lower 48, doing all sorts of field studies, vegetation studies, marine mammals, wetlands, fisheries, traditional knowledge consultation, cultural resources, a very substantial effort around that, by sending people out in the field and seeing, comparing what we see on a map with what's actually going on in the field, and a lot of this information was passed back through the engineering teams to ensure that the pipeline could be constructed in a environmentally robust fashion. One positive thing, it was about 200,000 staff hours. We managed to do this in a very distributed sense, using aircraft, helicopters, trucks, a little bit of everything, and no one got seriously hurt in any of the activity, because we did instill the importance of being careful out there when they're out in very, very remote areas of Alaska and Canada.
This is Joe Marushak again. I'll take you through the next three or four pages on the feasibility study.
Now, could I interrupt you just a minute?
Sure.
Is that written comments you have before you? If it is, I'd like you to fax it to 465-6813.
Representative Williams, no, all we have is, you have the slides in front of you, don't you?
Yes.
That's what we're talking from. We don't have anything other than that.
Okay, that's fine. And for the record, all members of the committee are present, and I see out there Senator Torgerson.
Okay. Under the updated project feasibility, I'm on slide 14. What we were able to get out of this is significantly improved project definition, a lot better understanding of risks and opportunities. When we talk about risks of opportunities, we're talking about where the project could get more expensive for us, and ideas on how we may be able to reduce the project cost at some time in the future. This is the future engineering studies that we alluded to earlier. The study results are as follows. We have a higher capital cost project. We'll show you that in a minute. Capital costs have gone up fairly significantly on both sides of this project. Partially, that is because we keep trying to make an economic project, and one way we tried to do that was to increase the volumes delivered. That's why Ken indicated a few minutes ago that we're up bumping up against an annual average of about 4.3 BCF a day, largest pipeline in the world. We've got lower operating costs. We've got reduced fuel consumption. We have what we think is probably the most advanced pipeline design at this point also. Current capital cost estimates vary from plus 20% to minus 20%. Now, each of the companies probably has a little different view of that, but generally, I think order of magnitude, this is what you'd get out of, we agree this is what you'd get out of feasibility phase, which is where we're in right now. Certainly achieving lower costs and less uncertainty is going to require substantial future investment. The next phases of this project would be multi-hundreds of millions of dollars, either in permitting, design engineering. We've spent $125 million so far. Anything we do from here on forward would be probably a multiple of that. The project has a lot of risks associated with it, not the least of which are political risks and regulatory risks. And we'll address what we're trying to do with some of those issues. There remain fiscal risk and cost risk. Cost risk in particular are technical that we, a lot of the work we've done so far here, and the long-term prices and market volatility. The really, really important point, though, is that this risk, regardless of who owns the pipeline, whether it's a pipeline company or some other arrangement, the risk of this project is going to fall on the producers. There may be some cost-sharing mechanisms depending on who owns this, but by and large, we believe that most of the cost is going to be borne by the producers in terms of the tariff. And we're going to have to commit for a long period of time that regardless, once this project starts, that we will pay that tariff on pretty much a take-or-pay basis. So a huge amount of risk comes on our balance sheet, and we haven't seen any way of getting around that. I don't think there is any way. Pipeline pretty much acknowledged that also.
We have a question here, Representative Bundy.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. In the political risk arena, I guess, it's been pretty clear that producers would favor the northern route. It's obviously shorter and maybe geographically less challenging. And we have a bill before us discussing certain incentives. Would the producers think that these incentives would be available if you chose a northern route?
Well, I think this is Ken Conrad with BP. I think we've tried to communicate fairly clearly for some time now that it's none of our intention, certainly not BP's intention, to go forward with a project that isn't supported by the respective host government. So I think route is really a decision for governments to make, and if governments determine that you can't do one of them, which is so far what we've heard from Alaska, that kind of becomes the lay of the land. However, I think Alaska's made that decision based on it's been an informed choice, and they recognize that puts another cost hurdle in front of the project. But it's really we've recognized all along that a project of this magnitude needs the support of governments, and no one's going to contemplate trying to do a $20 billion project when people don't want to do it.
Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you.
Representative Bundy, this is Joe Marushak again also. You're probably aware also that Phillips had indicated some time ago that if it would move the project along, we would be happy to focus on the southern route. So I'm not sure the premise that you set out there was that I would completely agree with. In any regard, Phillips right now is focused on the southern route.
Thank you.
Capital costs and tolls, page 15. This is a summary of the capital costs of this project, sales rate, and the project tolls. And you can, I'll just hit the high points on this. What we see for the southern route, about $19.4 billion. And I need to point out, that is $2,001. When you invest that in dollars of the day, you're going to be up around $30 billion. This does assume all four legs of the project, which are the gas treatment plant, $2.6 billion, and Alaska to Alberta segment. And when we say Alaska to Alberta, we're talking about a point that we've selected at this point in time of Vegreville, which is more in the central part of Alberta. It's close to the NGL facilities at Fort Saskatchewan. We've also included in here an Alberta to market section, which is $4.6 billion in an NGL facility. On the northern route, you can see that the Alaska to Alberta section has about $800 million difference, lower cost there. We are assuming, though, that we pick up a BCF a day from the Mac Delta producers, so there's a cost going to them of about $1.4 billion, $18.6 coming to the Alaska producers. Again, plus or minus 20% around these capital cost numbers. Sales rate south, 4.3. Sales rate north, 4.3 plus 1 for Mac Delta, 5.3. And then we've listed some order of magnitude project tolls for you there also, where on the southern route, about $2.39. On the northern route, about $2.31 per m. And the range on that plus or minus 20% is roughly $1.90 to $2.80. And you can see with the northern, they're fairly close in there. Another point I'd like to make on this is the pipeline companies generally stop at Gordondale, which is on the eastern side of Alberta, where you connect into the Trans-Can system. On the western side, yeah. If you look at miles basis, bottom line is the toll that you have to pay has to cover getting through Canada one way or another. So whether you stop at Gordondale or Vegreville, the toll ends up being pretty much the same way. Another point I'd like to make is that even though Kent said we may or may not have to build the B2C portion down to market, there's still a toll to be paid. The toll you're seeing here is substantially less than anything we're aware of in the market right now. Again, if Canadian infrastructure can expand and accommodate this gas, that's great. If they can't, this is our fallback position here, and you can see what the cost is.
Representative Croft has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. It's my understanding that under the federal legislation, they're guaranteeing, once that gets out of conference, a $3.25 price in Alberta or a $3.75 price at market, Chicago, I guess. And doesn't that, on these ranges, produce a tariff that, even taking your 20% number, that is the high tariff number, which incorporates 20% increased costs, that's still just under a buck of minimum guaranteed wellhead price.
Joe Marucci, Representative Croft, through the chair. If you take the $325 price and you, first of all, Alberta, AECO is different than these numbers here, but in any regard, where the direction you're heading here, even if you got a dollar at the wellhead, you still have to pay your operating costs, your severance, your royalty, and we'd like to have some profit left over off that thing. The other point here is that mechanism that you're talking about, that covers market risk. It does not cover capital risk. And even though we're saying right now that this is plus or minus 20 in feasibility, this is not design engineering. Design engineering costs hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars. The TAPS program, as I understand it, had about a nine-fold overrun, eight to nine-fold overrun. Any overrun in this project would be directly reflected in higher tariffs, which would eat away at that 325. There is no cost containment in that number. It's purely a market number. So this project has extreme amount of risk, and that's why you're seeing there's a lot of caution around this for a pretty tough project one way or another. So you can add up the numbers any way you want to, but what I'm telling you is all that covers is market. Does not cover cost overruns.
No, it's clear, as we said, this is Ken Conrad, I'm sorry, through the chair, it's clear as we're trying to communicate that the way we make this project successful, which we all desperately want to do, is to reduce the risks and reduce the costs. And then the risks are regulatory risk, fiscal risk, and cost risk is our job to manage that, but it's going to require a substantial future investment, and we do have a history here in Alaska of overrunning projects, be it TAPS, which was a nine-fold overrun, be it North Star, which had a substantial overrun in part because of lawsuits and regulatory delays, and some of the other bigger projects have also had overruns. So wouldn't read plus or minus 20% is what we came up with, but that doesn't necessarily mean that that's what the answer is going to be.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Chairman. Thank you. Representative Whitaker.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Then to whomever cares to answer, the wellhead less operating, is that pipeline operation or field operation?
It would be field operation.
Okay. Your pipeline operation then would be included in tariff?
That is the cost of the pipeline operation, is the tariff, plus the profit on that, plus your depreciation, plus all your taxes on the pipeline, yes.
Correct. So the operation that you're speaking of is separate from the operation of the pipeline, which, as being inclusive in the tariff, includes a return on investment. Is that correct?
Yes. This is what you've got in the 239 or 280-31 is all the operating costs of the pipeline and the gas treatment plant, the new build stuff that we have to do there, plus all your servicing costs for those particular new builds. This has nothing to do with what it takes to get the gas to that gas treatment facility.
Okay.
Or the associated royalty tax and oil losses, which there will be some oil losses associated with.
You're going to have to acknowledge who you are.
I'm sorry. This is Ken Conrad, VP.
Okay, just a couple more questions.
Senator Whitaker, yeah.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm trying to establish then that over and above the wellhead, there is a return on investment that's included in the tariff. Is that correct?
Joe Marucci, that's correct.
And that amount is?
What we have assumed in this case is 70-30, is the tariff is based on an assumption, again, it's Joe Marucci, an assumption of what would be approved by FERC for the way this project would be developed, which we've assumed 70% debt, 30% equity. And we have assumed for project purposes at this point in time that equity would command a minimum 12% rate of return. And this is Robbie Shillam, and again, you know, that 12% is for the pipeline portion of this. So whoever owns the pipeline, that's what we're talking about.
I understand. Thank you.
For the gas treatment plant.
For the record, we have several other legislators here. I see Representative Cessna, Katula, Chenault, Masick, and Cott. Oh, go ahead, gentlemen.
I'll try to cover a page or two more here. This is, again, Joe Marushak with Phillips. Next page is our estimated government takes. And what we've done here, these are undiscounted dollars, so they're dollars of the day. But what we've tried to do is add up all the takes that come from the various sources that the governments would get. Roughly, the numbers are about the same, regardless of if it's Northern Route or Southern Route. This also assumes the pipeline is full, meaning 4.3 BCF a day, for 30 years, plus a tail, a decline tail that goes along with that thing. So we have had to assume in this case 51 TCF of gas, which is about 16 more than we have right now. The idea being we have built in that there will be discoveries on the slope. Again, some might argue this is aggressive. What we're trying to do is come up with a way to do this project and make it economic. If we assume less gas than this, we would have a higher tariff. What this leaves you with is about $50 billion in state of Alaska revenues, about $39 billion of U.S. federal revenues, and about $28 billion of Canadian federal revenue, Canadian revenues. And that includes, in both cases, that a Mackenzie pipeline would be done one way or another, either over the top connecting up with this, or if you went south, there would be a separate Mackenzie Delta pipeline. This also assumes an EIA government forecast on price. Obviously, different price forecasts, you get different numbers, higher or lower.
Representative Mulder.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Joe, there's been some discussion put forward by Department of Revenue, discrepancy between the $28 and $50 billion. My understanding is that that translates between known reserves and estimated reserves. Is that accurate?
Through the chair, Representative Mulder, again, I don't actually know what the state has in their numbers, but it would be, we have ran this before where we have not, where we've tried to have numbers that didn't include exploration success in there. And obviously the numbers would be substantially lower than that if you did that, but I don't personally know what's in their numbers. I do know we have, we've got a big chunk of betting on the come here built in ours.
Okay, and that's based upon the fact that no one's looked for our gas really before aggressively and never really would unless you have a means for which to bring a return on it, correct?
I think that it's not exactly our rationale for doing it, but I think that is correct. That it's kind of our thought process. If you build the pipeline, people will discover gas. That's right.
Okay, gentlemen, continue on.
I question, Mr.
Representative Whitaker has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Gentlemen, again, to whomever would care to answer, the one number I don't see here is the other distribution of income. What's the industry take?
Let's see. This is Robbie Shillam. Best of my recollection, the industry is about 40% of what the government, I think it's a 60-40 split, so it's somewhere in that range, about 40% of that.
I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman, if I can clarify.
Yes.
40% of what?
I'm sorry, 40% of the government take is the producer take. I believe that's correct.
Are those equivalent net dollars? Are those net dollars?
I'm sorry, when you say net dollars?
I mean just that, net dollars. We're not talking gross, we're talking net.
Well, I believe that's what we're talking about. The when you say that the $120 billion here is a net to the government?
Yes.
And about $40 billion would be in the range to the producers.
And then, Mr. Chairman, one last question. The price floor, now we're assuming that we're talking today's dollars, at 325 and 51 TCF, I'm having difficulty reconciling gross dollars to the numbers that we have here. Could you help me on that, please?
I'm sorry. Apologies, this is Joe Maruchak. I didn't understand your question. The 325, you know, doesn't enter into this equation at all here. We're using the EIA forecasts, which start out, and feel free, one of the guys correct me, but I think the EIA forecasts start out around 310, something like that, but we'd have to get you the firm number on that. No, that's not right. That's not the right number. I don't recall what the right number is on that. We're using the EIA forecast, though.
Okay, that's fine. That's available, and a good place to start. Thank you very much.
Representative Croft.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Very briefly on that point, if the government of the total net profit takes about 60% and you guys have about 40% of it, with $120 billion government take, wouldn't the number be 80? It seems like $200 billion of total, 60% to the government is 120, 40% is 80 billion that the industry would take. Are my numbers right there?
This is Ken Conrad. What I might suggest is that we get back to you with those numbers. I think we're maybe getting into compound areas. I think the fundamental notion is that governments make a lot of revenues. Clearly, there's rewards for the producers or the sellers of the gas. It's a smaller number than this, but it is a substantial number. The difference is that the producers have to pay the money and that's what we're trying to do, is to achieve that in a way where the risks are in balance with the rewards. And of course, being a major oil and gas company, this is the sort of business we would love to do. It's a strategic piece of business. We've just got to get the risks in balance with the rewards. But certainly there's very substantial revenues coming out of this project. However, there are substantial costs, which is a little bit different between the government view, which there are some costs, but not quite the same order of magnitude.
Thanks. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Any other questions on this portion?
Yeah.
Continue on.
Okay. This is Joe Baruchak again. I'll do this last page here. Expansion has been a requirement of the producer group we're working on this project, even though, I'm down at an Arctic conference today, and I've heard that we've Cadillac'd this thing. We've not Cadillac'd it. What we've tried to do is build in the opportunity for expansion. And this is just an example of that. It's built into our system, and yes, small debottlenecks are likely to improve the volumes from the 4.3. Generally, what we find when we do projects is afterwards, engineers find a way of tweaking the numbers up, tweaking a little bit, and one could expect that might happen here too, although it's not a sure thing. But generally, when we talk about expansion, we're talking about the major expansion that would come with new discoveries. And this case, this project that we've built, is designed so that with what we know right now on a design basis, we start out with a tariff that is close to the lowest you could get, and then when you expand this by adding interim compression, of which our design would have valves in place, so all you'd have to do is go back and drop a substantial amount of compression again, a huge amount of compression, but nonetheless, interim compression that would be already available, there'd be a way of doing that quite easily. Then you can get up to this 5.6 BCF a day case. Obviously, you can go higher than that, but once you start going higher than that, then you're starting to get into more fuel use, more compression, and your curve, if you will, is starting to come up. The right-hand side here, what you see, is just an example where you can see that the way we've designed this, and this is just a pictorial curve, you can see that the cost of this project at where we've got the 4.3 is close to the bottom. When you expand, it's close to the bottom. Now, one thing you can't do, you can't just go halfway and still be at that curve because you have to put in all your compression. So, you wouldn't want to mislead people. You can put in all your compression and still be at the bottom of the curve. you do need substantial expansion to be towards the bottom of the curve. But that's already been designed into this thing. And you could, and one of the points I tried to make earlier on there, we're banking on exploration successes in here. This is why this access issue that's been out there for a while that people talk about, it's based, it's in our FERC agreements, it's built into our system, and we actually need it or you wouldn't do this project.
Representative Whitaker has a question.
Thank you. Again, to whomever would care to answer, then am I interpreting this correctly? You will not expand until there is an additional BCF per day to expand with. Is that correct? Is that the point at which you reach the appropriate scale to make it efficient?
This is Ken Conrad with BP. Certainly, we're saying an expansion of this order of magnitude would be efficient. It's a function of how much horsepower you want to add. It is interim compression, but it's going to depend on what the customers want and or need at that point in time. Lower volume expansions could also obviously be done. We haven't specifically engineered those. They may be slightly less efficient, but there's actually a continuum of opportunities in here. What we've tried to do is highlight the potentially the most efficient one, but there can be smaller ones, there can be larger ones. It depends on what the needs of the market are.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Any other questions?
Okay, if you turn to page 18, this is Robbie Schilling with ExxonMobil. I'll close out with these last four pages. And these really cover what we call the three-legged stool that we're looking for as far as government framework to improve and reduce the risk. We talked about earlier, first one is the U.S. enabling regulatory legislation. Second one is the predictable fiscal framework in Alaska. And then the last one is the clear and predictable regulatory process in Canada. We really feel like, as Ken said a while ago, we're not going to go forward with a project that's not supported really by all the stakeholders and those that are involved in that, and it includes the investors, the governments, First Nations and Native communities, the shippers, the marketers, and the consumers. And that's really the recipe for success on a pipeline like this. As we said earlier, significant forward expenditure really requires having a predictable framework in place so that there are no surprises and we have predictability around the economics. And once the government framework is established and put in place, then hopefully a commercially viable pipeline project can be found, but it will still be essential to move forward and lower the cost and the risk of the project. Turn to page 19 to talk a little bit about the U.S. enabling regulatory legislation. First of all, this really follows the Senate Energy Bill that was passed at the end of last week. Again, that enabling legislation is something that we had been pushing for and working with the U.S. Senate since last July. It's available to any sponsor. We think that it's a good legislation that keeps it in place if somebody, if Foothills wants to use that, or it would open up a market-driven process for others to come forward with any viable project. Again, this would establish a clear process to encourage a competitive market-driven solution, allows any number of the producers or pipeline partnerships to come forward and evolve. And then finally, you have the regulatory risk that discourages the investments out of the way. The keys to it is expedited the environmental review and the project authorization, and then provide for timely judicial review to reduce uncertainty. On page 20, a summary of the Alaska fiscal certainty. This would provide for certainty in the state government take, and really that's what we're looking for is certainty around this so that it would be predictable as we go forward and determine the future economics of a project like this. The predictability around the disposition of the state royalty gas consistent with the firm transportation commitments that have to be made, and a clear and simple predictable gas valuation for the royalty and the severance tax payments, the severance tax rates and the ELF rates around the ad valorem tax and the valuation methodology and the corporate income taxes.
Representative Mulder has a question.
I'm sorry to digress, gentlemen, but there's been some question. You know, some folks have assumed that the federal ceiling and floor are pretty much a done deal. Reading the comments in the paper this weekend, it seems anything but that is true. What's your take on the situation right now?
Well, I think each of us probably see things differently or hear things, and I guess I've just read the same things that you have, Representative Mulder, that I guess as that process has gone forward, there's some people questioning the utility of that. And it's just the debate will still remain to be out there.
Representative Mulder, this is Joe Marushak, if I may.
Sure.
It made it through the Senate, which is a good thing. Through the conference, though, it's going to have to be thoroughly reviewed and debated. And I think it's safe to say that it's got a ways to go. And I think that the state of Alaska is going to need to help move this thing through as a way to get this project through. So yeah, I would be the last person to say this is a done deal.
And to put it into comparison or perspective, is it safe to say that without the federal provisions, this project looks like a non-starter?
Again, this is Joe Marushak of Phillips. What we have said, I am going to directly answer your question. We think this is extremely important. We think that you need to have the federal enabling legislation, the federal tax incentive, or tax mechanism, if you will, the floor price, if you will. We think we need state fiscal certainty, but we think if you get those three things, there's a way of moving forward to the next step. Now, there's still other things that have to happen. You still have to have an economic project. Ad valorem tax holiday is helpful. The bond financing is helpful. Accelerated depreciation from the federal government is helpful. But, yes, in order for us to move forward, I think we think that this has to happen.
Okay. You've pretty much answered. I was trying to put in perspective the considerations that Alaska is giving in relation to the consideration the federal government's giving. I mean, theirs is a very, very big, significant piece of the chunk or boost, and ours is a relatively small but very significant piece nonetheless.
That's right, and they're entirely different processes too. What the federal side does is help on downside risk, doesn't add anything to the economics. What Alaska ad valorem tax holiday would do would actually improve the economics a little bit, but more important than that, helps us demonstrate that Alaska's got some skin in the game and Alaska wants the project to happen. So, but very different. They're not related in my mind at all in why you do them.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Representative Mulder, through the chair, this is Robbie Shillen with ExxonMobil. Let me just mention, because there is a little bit of a departure here, from ExxonMobil's standpoint, we don't seek nor do we support any kind of government subsidies for a project. We really feel like that a project needs to stand on its own merits, and if it does, then go forward with the project. If it does not, then it's really incumbent upon us to find ways or let the market change in order to have a project to come forward and become economic. So it's a little bit of difference, but you'll see that as we go into this and the questions come up, that's why we respond in the manner that we do. We just do not feel like that we have an economic project right now and that we're working towards it in other manners.
We have several questions here. Representative Harris, Hudson, and Croft.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is, I guess, to either any one of the three. Just interesting comments from Exxon. But when you say Alaska fiscal certainty, and you have five bullet points in there, none of them are tax holiday, ad valorem tax holiday listed, but ad valorem tax rates certainly are in valuation methodology. In your opinion, collectively or individually, is a tax holiday during the, an ad valorem tax holiday during the construction period of the pipeline something that will make or break the project in your eyes, or is it just a added incentive?
This is Ken Conrad with BP through the chair. I think, you know, as we scrub through this project, which is an enormous project, I don't think we can ever point to any one thing that's going to be the magic bullet. What we need clarity and predictability, regulatory side and the fiscal side, there's probably going to need to be we're outlining here five or six of the key things that are going to have to happen, and this could be one of them. Certainly, we know we need to reduce costs, and we think hopefully we can do some of that if we do invest the next several hundred million dollars. But there's no question that property tax holiday is another way of reducing costs, but that's fundamentally a decision for governments to take, whether they what signal they want to send to investors. There is no one thing that's going to make this happen. As Joe said earlier, it's actually going to take a number of forward steps and kind of everyone rowing in the boat together, as opposed to one independent thing.
One quick follow-up, Mr. Chairman, if I could. Maybe I could get just a just a follow-up on Robbie showed, I guess, from Exxon. Did I take your comments to say that you weren't concerned about the validity, economically or otherwise, of this project wasn't based upon anything that government may or may not do to help incentivize the project? It had to stand on its own merits in your eyes without any kind of government help?
Representative Paris, this is Robbie Shillen through the chair. Yes, that's what I said. We don't seek nor do we support incentives or subsidies that we would look at a project like this having to stand on its own merit.
Thank you.
Robbie, and to follow that up, but you also don't feel this project is economically viable, correct?
Yes, I don't know who I'm speaking to, but that's correct.
Representative Hudson. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I'm going to get to the Alaska fiscal certainty. It seems strange to me that you folks must be equally concerned about our ability to bring our revenues in line with our spending for fiscal certainty, because as long as we have $1 billion imbalance there, I can't imagine how any major investment by the oil industry would feel like we're not going to try to make that difference up on you folks. Is that an issue of concern to you?
This is Ken Conner with BP. Absolutely, and that's when we talk about the notion of simple, clear, predictable tax take off a project, that's certainly in the background, and that's why, we have a history of disputes and after-the-fact changes and settlements, which we know this project can't tolerate economically. And secondly, the point you made is that the overall fiscal picture in Alaska is wobbly, and that's why there's going to need to be a high degree of confidence that whatever rules we come up with, that those rules won't change. And irrespective of what the economics are, that's something that we're going to need to find a way to do, and that's one of the reasons we've been so supportive of the notion of reenacting the old Stranded Gas Act to help us get into a conversation to find a way to do that with the state, because without that predictability, I don't think we can ever contemplate making an investment of this scale.
Representative Croft.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Two quick questions. To the comment that you didn't want a subsidy to make a non-viable project viable, isn't a tax holiday a subsidy? It seems to me if I tell somebody they don't have to pay their taxes because I want to support a particular industry, that's very like a subsidy.
Representative Croft, through the chair, this is Joe Marushak. I think what you're hearing is some of the philosophy on this particular project from three different companies. Phillips' position is that this is one of Phillips' position is this is one of several building blocks that we're very interested in that we think would help make the project viable. So yes, there is I see value in the ad valorem tax holiday, just like I see value in accelerated depreciation, which reduces cost. I think the railroad bonds would ultimately reduce the tariff. I think technological advances, which we think there may be some we'd like to study, would reduce the cost. So this is just one of several. And I'd like to follow up. Someone asked, is this a make or break? No, it's not a make or break. I agree with Ken. But it's extremely important, and it sends the right message in helping us do the other things we're trying to do to make this project move along. But I think what's getting confused there is different companies have different views on these things.
Okay.
Yeah, this is Ken Conrad with BP through the chair, just to make sure we're laser clear on this. We will evaluate the project based on the rules that are in place at any given time, and that's why this fiscal predictability is so important. And whatever the rules are, that's the way we'll evaluate the project. There's no question that taxes are by far the biggest cost of this project, but that's really for governments to decide how they want to tax the project and what sort of signals they want to send. That's their choice. But what we want to do is know what it is and be able to evaluate it, because it is a big decision even for a company of our size. So if governments think that business development property taxes are a good thing, and of course they're done around the country, and there's always great debate about it wherever it occurs. That's a decision for governments. We just want to know with clarity what governments want to do so we can evaluate the project against that.
Real briefly, one more.
Representative Croft.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Back on page 15, I've been playing with the numbers here. If I understand the southern route, I just put a big yellow sticky over the northern route. I didn't even look at that one. But on the southern route, the gas treatment is 41 cents of the toll. Alaska to Alberta is 1.36, or about a total of $1.77, $1.77 to get it to Alberta, where if the Senate, if the energy bill is passed as the Senate did, that would be a $3.25 minimum price. Seems to me that even if your $1.77 toll is 50% off, not 20, that yields a tariff to Alberta of $2.66, still leaving 60 cents of wellhead value for the gas. Did I add that right?
Representative Croft, not exactly. The $1.36 gets you to Gordondale. Gordondale is substantially different than ACO Hub, which is more Calgary. So part of that 62 cents needs to go into where you're trying to get to anyway. But more concern there is, this project is probably the riskiest project. I don't know if it's one of the most risky projects in our entire portfolio. We're certainly concerned about moving forward with this project and finding that it's not 20%, but it's a huge number over that. As I said, TAPS was 8 times. A lot of people still have that in their mind. I don't think you're going to get us to agree that just that ACO price alone makes this project happen. It's one of the most important things, but there's a lot of issues that have to be addressed here.
And Ken Conrad with BP through the chair, as Joe said earlier, this what's not shown on here is the operating costs, other investments that need to be made to mitigate oil losses themselves, royalty and severance. So these costs are just the pipeline itself. It's not the total cost picture.
Wonderful. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Were the producers involved in the drafting of the U.S. energy legislation? Were you asked to be involved in it?
This is Ken Conrad with BP through the chair. Yes, we were. It's actually legislation that we proposed as an idea to mitigate regulatory risk in the last June-July time frame, and we've been working fairly closely with a number of folks to try and get that to a form that everyone could embrace.
Yeah, that's all for now. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Whitaker.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have several, and I'll go as quickly as I can, if I may, please. Thank you. Gentlemen, on page 20, at the top of the page, predictable disposition of state royalty gas consistent with firm transportation commitments. Would a royalty in kind sale to a third party, that third party then making transportation commitments, would that be sufficient to provide you with the certainty that you need?
This is Ken Conrad with BP through the chair. I think the we're very supportive of the state taking its gas in kind, as long as when it takes it, it promises to take it. I think one of the issues that's been floating around is the taking kind sale as it has been currently constructed is set up such that we'll take our gas in kind, but we may change our mind later and put it back to you after you've made your financial commitments and revenue projections and fundamentally change your economics. I think that's the issue we need to make sure we get right. Taking in kind itself is a great thing. It's actually a form of fiscal stability or fiscal predictability, as long as it's done in a predictable fashion. Right now, some of the notions going around, it's actually adds to the unpredictability, and that's an area of concern.
So then, to follow up, if that were structured in a manner as to provide predictability, that would be acceptable to you. Is that correct?
Absolutely, yes.
Okay. Next question. Clear, simple, predictable gas valuation for royalty and severance payments. We have an existing regime. Is there any question as to the clarity of that existing regime?
Ken Conner, BP, yes, there is. And I think that's the process we would envision, as we outlined last summer, is to sit down with folks in government to make sure we're very clear in terms of how we're interpreting that. I think everyone sees the headline severance rate. It's just the details of interpretation, which is part of the history of the last 20 years on the oil side, and what we want to do is learn from that and fix those problems before they happen.
Do you see then impediments to a successful project given the existing regime, which is unclear?
Yeah, it's just a question of bringing simplicity and clarity to the existing scheme.
And also reducing the rate, potentially?
No, I think what we're talking about is clear, simple, and predictable.
Okay, very good. Then, Mr. Chairman, if I might, just a couple more. Severance and ELF. Same question, I'm assuming same answer.
This is Ken Conrad. I think it's simple, clear, and predictable is the answer for all the elements of state take, as otherwise it's almost impossible to evaluate the project.
Very good, and I was hoping that would be the answer to all of those, and I think that there is a mechanism that is inherent to the legislation before us, whereby the date to apply for essentially a clarity session or several of them, and to stop my stammering and stuttering here, but the Stranded Gas Act does provide that mechanism to clarity for you, does it not?
Yeah, it doesn't solve it, but it sets out a process, and that's why we've certainly been supportive of the bill.
And the result of that process then would be the clarity that you need, is that correct?
That would certainly be our aspiration, yes.
Okay, thank you very much.
Representative Bundy.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The question for the representative from Exxon, were you part of the crafting, consulted at least on crafting of the federal legislation regarding the pipeline?
Representative Bundy, through the chair, this is Robbie Shillam. The answer is yes. We participated in crafting the base language for the enabling legislation that provided the predictability and the judicial review and the expedited process with the federal inspector
you know, those provisions we were.
And, Mr. Chairman, and are you supportive of the result?
Representative Bundy, through the chair, we are supportive of the base enabling legislation that was proposed last July. We are not supportive of some of the results, including the mandates around routes and then some of the other provisions that that have been added as amendments, primarily around access and expansion and loyalty in kind.
But it sounds then as if you were supportive of the financial aspects or the subsidy.
No, we were not. I'm sorry if I failed to include that one, but we do not support the financial subsidies.
Okay, thank you.
Are there any more questions for this portion? Continue on, gentlemen.
Well, this is Robbie Shillup. Let me just finish with the last page, or page 21, kind of briefly around the predictable National Energy Board First Nations regulatory process in Canada. And again, they're trying to establish the regulatory process between the NEB and First Nations to basically expedite the overall process. The process there in place now is cumbersome. It would probably take in the 40 to 45 month range. And in the governments there are laying out a cooperation plan between the federal, the provincial, the territorial, and the First Nation regulatory bodies. And we're participating in that, in commenting and working with them to get this process, this permitting process, in line with the U.S. process. So hopefully we can work through that and avoid duplication and some of the other processes that were causing delays in getting that getting a permit. With that, let me just get you to turn to page 23, our wrap-up slide. Hopefully you've got it in color. There's a picture there of the in the background of the trenching trials, the trenching test that we've just concluded in on the North Slope in the Fairbanks area, where we were taking the trenchers and testing different techniques to understand the productivity and try to improve the process around that. We feel like that was successful. We're gathering the data now, and we'll be analyzing that. Overall, as a wrap-up, as we talked about, right now the risk-reward balance on a project is not attractive, and we're working to try to improve that. We've talked about the viable government frameworks to get improved that are essential to us moving forward. Our joint team concluded their work. We feel really proud of the effort that team gave us. Those guys have now just have been redeployed back into their organizations. And then as the companies, three companies will continue to collaborate as appropriate on future work, such as these trenching trials and other ways to reduce the cost and also to work with the various governments. With that concludes our prepared remarks.
Are there any questions at this time? Any further questions, Representative Harris? His question.
Just have a couple of questions that brought up to me, or at least ideas that have been brought up to me. Are there any talks with the Canadians? You mentioned the First Nations and that about any kind of incentives or tax holidays or any kind of a situation like that with the Canadian government.
Representative, through the chair, this is Joe Marushak, Representative Harris. Not at this point. We have focused on federal for the most part that we've seen so far, and then now we're moving into Alaska, but we need to be working with the First Nations also. At this point in time, we have not. The benefits to the Canadians, especially on the southern route, are significantly less than they are to Alaskans. To us in Alaska and the
federal government. So I don't think we haven't gone that route yet, but I don't think you're going. It would be. I think it'd be inappropriate to think we're going to get that same sort of commitment out of them. What they see is the opportunity for jobs, maybe some access, but they don't get any royalty value. They don't get the opportunity to develop huge infrastructures like we may be able to do in Alaska. So I think the thought process is different.
Yeah, this is Ken Connor with BP through the chair. There have been some discussions, not for this project specifically, but some discussions initiated by the Canadian government around the notion of accelerated depreciation for pipelines in general to bring their system more in line with the U.S. system. And secondly, just an observation that in terms of property tax, most of the jurisdictions in Canada already have a system that's measurably less burdensome than the current one in Alaska. Thank you.
Representative Davies.
Thank you. I guess I'm a little puzzled by that statement that the southern route is less valuable to the Canadians, because I thought you said earlier when you were doing the summary that you assumed that in either way the Mackenzie portion would be built. So it seems like they're going to develop the Mackenzie stuff under either scenario.
Representative Davies, yes. What I said was this slide here assumed that the Mackenzie Valley was developed, and so part of those $29 billion in revenues you see there are associated with a separate Mackenzie Delta line, not solely with the southern route line. Solely on the southern route, there would not be $29 billion of revenues under this basis.
I guess let me put the question in a little more direct way. In terms of building the Mackenzie River portion of this, if that were to be built, would tax holidays play any role in that process?
Well, this is Robbie Shillip. I guess the intent of what we were trying to show here is that if we build a southern pipeline, that the any kind of Mackenzie pipeline would be solely independent, and there would be no association within the two projects.
Representative Co-Chair Mulder.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Gentlemen, obviously tax exemptions or tax holidays aren't new, but they're relatively new for us. How frequently are these used around the country and around the world?
Representative Mulder, this is Joe Marushak. I can tell you that on several of the big projects I have worked on in the states, municipalities compete for these projects in their areas by offering ad valorem tax holidays is fairly common. On a world scale, don't know for sure. You're usually negotiating on a kind of a different basis there in terms of, like when you negotiate your leases, your drilling leases, it's a different basis there, and you've made certain commitments, and you have the opportunity to move out of that if you don't want to move forward with the project. I think what we're doing here, though, in my view, how this looks like is we're not necessarily competing against other municipalities, but the thought process is the same. This is a world-scale project, one of the largest world-scale projects, and I think to some extent what we're doing is competing with other world-scale projects. This project has enormous risk. Some others don't have enormous risk. One of the concerns that we've got is once you start moving forward with this project, you're basically there. There's no way of turning this project off. Once you're starting to buy steel, you're into it, and a lot of things can go wrong. That's why we keep saying that there's, logistics is very important, but planning's important, and getting a base project that at least somewhat competes with other opportunities is important, not through reducing risk, but also through whatever we can do to make the project a little less risky. But I think you're comparing on a world scale, so I think the argument's about the same.
Okay, Robbie, just to follow up on that, has Exxon utilized these advantages anywhere?
Representative Mulder, I'm not aware of any, but my background hadn't been in projects my entire career, but so I don't know of any. There, I mean, very very possibly could have if these things are offered or on the books, then we may have taken advantage of them. But again, we wouldn't have been asking for them or seeking them.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
I'm going to go to Senator Torgerson now, and if you gentlemen can hang on, there may be other questions. Senator. Yes, please do.
The Senate Mafia.
Senate Mafia. Hey, these guys work
do
for you.
Do you want to pull those tables out? Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. At your request and others today, they asked us to come and respond to the, I guess, the fiscal analysis, or if you can call it that, that we just received from the producers. I'd like to introduce people here on my right is Dr. Doug Reynolds. Dr. Reynolds is an oil and gas economist. He came on contract to the legislature February 7th, and he's been working here in Juneau since then, crunching numbers and putting together pipeline models. My left is Patrick Coughlin. Patrick's been working with Senate Resources for a year and a half. He's past deputy director of oil and gas, and before that was represented DNR oil and gas through Attorney General's office. I'm going to have to run to another committee that I chair here, and I'll leave these gentlemen here to answer your questions. I just would like to remind you that they're not policymakers. They work for us. They work for the legislature. And they'll certainly answer your questions, but try not to color them in a box on whether or not they like something or not. I will give you that opinion if you wish it. And it's free.
I'll
but
tell you what you like.
From their perspective, I would just ask you not to do that so they can maintain the neutrality. They work with all of us, whatever House or Senate or whatever party might be. I'm going to just go down through a little bit of the list of things that I think is missing from this report that we just read. I can tell you at the offset that I, for one, is disappointed after waiting for however many months for the conclusion to the $125 million study. We were told it was going to be due the 1st of January, 1st of February, 1st of March, then April. Now here's the 1st of May. I just went through and counted them up. Their financial summary... I lost it already. It consists of 8 numbers, 3 subtotals, 1 plus or minus 20%, and 1 tariff range. And that's what we've been given and expected to react, I guess, on whether or not we want to do anything based upon a report that I thought would be a lot more in-depth than just 8 numbers. But here are some of the things that are missing. And there's no particular order. So they haven't shared what product they're selling or at what price. We know that there are liquids involved in this, and there's a lot of value in those liquids. They haven't shared their evaluation criteria. They haven't shared their rate of return information. They haven't shared their pipeline tariff model. They haven't shared how the benefits of the federal floor price, and the federal loan guarantee, accelerated depreciation, state tax exempting, state property lease, or other fiscal changes that would affect the project economics. They haven't shared whether they expect Canadian jurisdictions to reduce their government take. They may have sort of answered that, but they haven't shared any information regarding when the pipeline would be expanded or the cost benefit of any expansion. They haven't shared their oil loss models, which is a huge part of this, what we might expect for loss of oil revenues. We know that they're mixing discounted and undiscounted dollars. We know that sometimes they use real numbers and sometimes they use inflated numbers. We know that they have agreed with the pipeline companies not to allow to share their numbers and tariffs, which we expect are lower, but they have collectively agreed not to share that, so we wouldn't have anything else to compare with. What we have seen so far, that they overstate state revenues by using inflation-proof dollars and extended the project beyond current feasibility. The $50 billion they're showing us is entirely new number to us because it showed 51 TCF over, they said today, a 30-year period. They told us a couple days ago it was 35-year. But in any degree, a whole new ballgame that nobody was using those numbers on to compare oranges and apples. My question to them is, why don't you use 100 TCF and show us make a whole lot more money? In order to have something that we can all debate and look at, you have to use the same set of numbers. Well, that was a total surprise from our economic partner point of view on entirely different numbers. In our model, using inflation dollars, the producers make more than 2.5 times what the state makes. So under the producer scenario, we estimate the producers take at $125 billion. Just a couple more, Mr. Chairman, you know. In our analysis, the pipeline, using their costs, achieves a return greater than 15%. Our preliminary analysis suggests that the property tax exemption during the construction period of 4 years slightly increases the return on the rate of return by 0.3%. And after that, if it's in a tax deferral, it hardly has any effect at all, but to some degree, but not too much effect. So I hope I've kind of got your saliva running on some questions, and I brought all the guys to answer them. but anyway, I just thought I'd start this out with a general overview of what I thought was lacking there. But before I conclude, I just want, this is part of the whole thing. You heard the producer say, well, we can't respond to revenues, $28 billion number that they came up with on the government take versus the $50 billion, because they haven't seen their numbers. It's the same thing. I can't respond to their numbers, and I'm sure you'll hear that from the team here today. We're working on that. We're trying to back-end load it now using the 8 numbers that they gave us to see if we can try to come up with a project model and come as close as we can. But it's never going to be... you can't do that unless you get everything laying on the table, everybody's looked at it, and you know exactly what you're doing. And right now, we do not have that information. But I wrote, just one last thing, I lied to you. That comes to $1.428 billion a year, $50 billion. So just think about that. That's a lot of money, and all the time we've heard about what a gas line would make for. I hope it does. I hope they're willing to sign a contract today. You give us 50 years of $1.428 billion, and maybe we'll just forget about all the other things and all the other taxes and just make them a deal that way. My guess is they wouldn't be willing to do that. Thank you.
We do have questions. Representative Davies.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator, how long have you been chair of the Joint Committee?
Since it started, I guess that'd be June. Oh, June of last year.
Coming on a year or so?
Yes.
Over the course of that period of time, how many times do you estimate that you've asked for input from the majors on what kind of tax holiday or tax structure they'd like in Alaska?
Well, certainly quite a few times, to the point of frustration, somewhere around the 1st of March or something like that, of asking them to, in writing, to get me something by a date certain, and I forget exactly what that date was. And I shared that letter with all, and their responses with all 60 representatives. But it's been frustrating. It's been almost a Chamber of Commerce kind of a thing that the state won't give us fiscal certainty. In this case, they don't like the deal. That's what fiscal certainty doesn't mean. They only want to make sure the deal's right. And I understand that. And a lot of the things we're talking about, I think they're going to get, you know, including property tax relief or royalty relief and a rewrite of severance. I have the bills done, but I don't lead my negotiations with insurance. That's how that is. So all the deals on the table, I just can't find myself going out and saying, here, let me give you this, which is a big negotiating chit, and then we'll work on the hard stuff a little later on. Just don't make any sense to me. Anyway, I don't know if I answered your question. I went off a little bit.
Representative Croft.
Just very briefly, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Well, to the representatives of the producers that are aligned, can you share with Senator Torgerson and us the background, the backup for the numbers that you have here in this presentation?
This is Ken Conrad with BP. I'm not sure exactly what the senator is after, but I'm sure if we could sit down with him. We could maybe share with them the assumptions that have gone in. I think we've tried to talk them through the 51.